Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Last November, I turned off the highway into a 2-pump gas station in the middle of nowhere at around 1:30 in the morning. I guess I was kind of zonked from how tired I was, because as I drove my car up to the pump, everything seemed as normal as could be. My eyes were locked on the pump display as I filled my car up, trying my best to not go a penny over 30 bucks, so it was only when I walked over to the kiosk to pay that I noticed something was off. The first thing that got my attention was how there was no one manning this kiosk. At first, I just waited, thinking the employee was just taking a quick bathroom break or something of that nature. But then as I started to look around, I realized the driver of the car at the pump in front of me was nowhere to be seen either. They weren't in their car, and they weren't inside the convenience store. So my first thought was how the driver and the gas station attendant must have been both in the back of the store, I guess. I got this momentary chill, thinking I might have interrupted a robbery or something, and I was suddenly very hesitant to knock on the glass or call for service. I remember turning to check out the car parked in front of me and thinking, if it's a Honda, then I'm getting out of here. But it looked to me like it was a 2011 3 Series. Now, if you don't know cars, Hondas are easy to steal. BMWs, on the other hand, not so much. And while that didn't completely preclude the possibility that there was a robbery in progress, it reassured me enough that I started knocking on the glass and asking if there was anyone there. I knocked once, and then twice, and then after the third time, I knocked on the glass in as many minutes, and it hit me that something highly unusual was clearly going on. My first thought was to try the door to the convenience store. I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be locked, but when I pushed, the door swung right open for me. I walked up to the counter, calling out,
"Hello?"
the whole time. And then, thinking there might have been some kind of medical emergency, I jumped the counter and took a look around the back of the store. There was a bathroom and a storage room and a small office, but all three were unlocked and empty. Then, and only then, did I realize that the entire gas station was completely deserted. I checked around the back just to be sure, but I figured that there'd be no one there. And then once I was 100% sure something seriously weird was going on, I pulled out my phone and got ready to dial 911. I wasn't still 100% sure what to do, so I called out hello again, but much louder. And when that got no response, I called the cops. I could tell that, at first anyway, that the dispatcher thought that I was just some jerk customer who was angry my gas station attendant wasn't there when I needed them. But once I properly explained that there was literally no one to be found, anywhere on the premises or elsewhere, she started to take my call a little more seriously. She asked where I was, and when I told her, she asked if it looked like there had been a robbery. I remember asking, "How the hell would I know?" But she explained that if there had been a robbery recently, an employee might still be hiding somewhere. And I felt this sort of twinge of frustration because, like I said, I'd looked probably everywhere except the dumpster around the side of the gas station. And as I'm walking back from checking out the highway for signs of life, I just so happened to be passing it as the thought to open it popped into my head. I wanted to be able to say to the dispatcher, "There, I even checked the station's dumpster. There's definitely nobody here, ma'am." But when I opened the dumpster, there they were. I only caught a glimpse of what was inside before I dropped the lid of that dumpster and backed off like the thing was radioactive. But a glimpse was enough for me. There were two bodies in there, all bent out of shape with dark stains all over their clothes, and one of them was almost certainly wearing a gas station uniform. I remember saying something like, "Oh Jesus, oh my God," pacing away from the dumpster in a state of total shock, with the dispatcher in my ear.
"Sir? Sir, tell me what's going on, sir."
And I told her. They're in the dumpster. Jesus fucking Christ, they're in the goddamn dumpster. The cops arrived in about 10 to 15 minutes, and by then I'd run off near to the highway to puke up all the contents of my stomach. And I'd remembered that thing about preserving the integrity of crime scenes, so in a wild panic, I'd actually puked as I was running, then had to hold puke in my mouth for a few seconds before I puked even more out near the highway. And after that, I just walked back and forth hitting my vape until I saw a cop car heading towards me down the highway, and then after talking to one of the officers for a few minutes, he told me I was free to leave. I looked the whole thing up online the first chance that I got later, but although I found a bunch of stories about a member of the public, yours truly, finding some bodies at a gas station, there was nothing that explained how or why those two people had been killed. Never since, I've always been extra careful while driving at night, both in the sense that I keep a very close eye on my fuel gauge and try to avoid any nocturnal pit stops, but also, if a gas station looks a little too quiet, I'll avoid it altogether and just head to the next one.
Hey guys, thanks so much for all the support. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please feel free to do so.
It was around the time when I first started working as an Uber driver. The job was pretty good and everything until one night when I picked up these girls from a club. That night, after dropping a customer at his destination, I got a ride request from a nearby nightclub, so I accepted it and drove there. When I reached the pickup location, I noticed three hot girls dressed up in a revealing and sexy attire. One of them was kissing a stud-looking dude, and one of them was trying to hold the third one, who seemed extremely drunk. Those two got in as soon as they noticed the cab, while we waited for the third one to finish her long, never-ending makeout session. "Riley, are you coming?" the second girl called out while she pointed her finger, telling her to wait 2 minutes. I waited for almost 15 minutes while she finished her kiss and came towards the cab. She opened the left door and got in. For some reason, the girl looked pissed, which soon after I got to know why. "How could you do that with Betty's boyfriend while she's passed out? Betty thinks of you as her best friend." She said that, and I understood what was going on. "Oh, come on, Caroline, don't try to act like a saint. She will never find out if she just keeps her mouth shut," Riley replied while touching up her makeup. So, that player of a guy was this passed out hot girlfriend's boyfriend. What poor luck she has that her boyfriend was cheating on her best friend. I'd always heard about shit like this happening to people's lives, but I never witnessed it. And there I was, witnessing it during my work hours, through my customers. "You're saying this because you already know I would never tell her. And Peter had already hurt her enough. I don't want her to get hurt more by knowing that her best friend is also betraying her behind her back." She said that while gritting her teeth, and instead of feeling ashamed, Riley started laughing. "Chill out, girl. You let the heat get to you sometimes." She caressed her cheeks while saying that, and she took in her anger. "Let's just silently get to the apartment without making another sound." I took out her phone and started going through it after saying that. "You know what? Driver, stop the car. I'm going to teach Caroline here how to let off the steam." As she instructed, I stopped the car. "Are you mad or what? Driver, don't listen to her and continue driving." I listened to her instructions as well and started the car back again. At the same time, the third girl, Betty, opened her eyes while moaning. She still looked pretty drunk. But before she could act or fall asleep again, Riley held her and started kissing her. "What do you think you're doing, Riley?" She pulled them apart while Betty's drunk, gorgeous eyes were open in shock for a few seconds before passing out again. Her boyfriend's a terrible kisser, so I'm letting her experience a good kiss for once. She said while laughing out loud, even I, who wasn't supposed to care about what was going on in the passenger seats, was feeling disgusted by that girl. After that, they kept arguing the entire way. More like Caroline was the one arguing while Riley was passing weird remarks and laughing. As we reached the destination, Riley and Caroline got off while Riley instructed me to drop Betty at the address she provided me. "I know I should drop you off at your house, but my stepmom's going to chew my head off if I'm there another minute late," she said to her and then went off. I started driving to the address she gave me. As I was driving, I heard a sniffling sound from the back seat. I turned to see, and she was awake and crying. I could not ignore it and parked the car on the side and asked her if she needed anything. I know you must be thinking I'm some pathetic girl after hearing everything. I looked at her with a shocked expression while she continued. Yes, I heard everything. I knew about it long before tonight. After saying that, she started crying even louder. I didn't know what to do, so I took out a water bottle and passed it in her direction. She looked into my eyes for the first time and said, "You're handsome." Her compliment made me blush, but then she clumsily climbed over to the front seat next to mine and leaned over for a kiss. Even though I found her sexy and attractive from the start, but still kissing a girl in the drunken state seemed a bit odd, so I hesitated a bit, by which she thought I wasn't interested. But she pulled away saying, "Sorry if you don't want to." While she was saying that, her drunken eyes blinked in an odd manner, which I found extremely sexy and irresistible. So I grabbed her by her hair and started kissing her. When I was kissing her, I kept thinking, why would anyone ever cheat on a girl as amazing as her? And that her lips were as soft as vanilla. After the dose of that drug, I got carried away and ended up having sex with her in the car. She fell asleep in the car after that, and even though I wanted to have more of her, I still drove to the address her friend gave me to drop her off. After dropping her off, I went back to my apartment and could not stop thinking about her. The next day, as I was getting ready for my job, my boss called and told me that I was fired because I broke the company policy. I couldn't believe that she reported me after she was the one that came on to me first. I'm remembering this today because I got an anonymous text saying, "I'm sorry my friend did that. Can I make it up to you?" I didn't want anything to do with her, so I blocked the number and started to get ready for my new job.
At around 9:30 p.m. on the night of August 29th, 2002, 31-year-old Audrey Heron called home to excitedly announce that she'd gotten a raise. Her husband Jeff congratulated her on the good news before Audrey told him she'd soon be finishing her nursing shift at the Columbia Green Long-Term Healthcare Facility in Catskill, New York, where Audrey worked part-time. It was fantastic news for the couple, as the extra income would make providing for their two children considerably easier. An hour and a half later, at around 11 p.m., Audrey said goodnight to her fellow nurses, headed out into the parking lot to her 1994 Jeep Grand Cherokee, then began the drive back home. She made the same commute to and from work every single day, driving back and forth along State Route 23 in the Jefferson Heights area of Catskill, and that night was no different. One coworker claims that Audrey drove behind her for a few minutes after leaving the office. Given that the weather that night was rainy and foggy, it wasn't long before she lost track of Audrey on the dark, rain-slick roads. The drive from the nursing facility to Audrey's home in Freehold, New York, is about 12 to 15 miles, so 20 minutes driving time at the very most. Audrey's husband expected her home at around 11:25, and he usually stayed up to greet her as she came through the door. But that night, Audrey didn't show. It wasn't entirely unusual for Audrey to have her shift extended at short notice, either to cover another nurse or because a patient required urgent care. So initially, Jeff didn't bat an eyelid at his wife's absence. He didn't even bother to call the hospital to make sure she was actually still there. He just went to bed at his usual time, completely unconcerned. Jeff later recounted that he woke up at around 2 a.m., the morning of August 30th, and noticed that Audrey was still not home. But again, due to the erratic nature of the job, he simply went back to bed, assuming that there had been some kind of emergency. The following morning, Jeff awoke at around 6 a.m. to find that Audrey still hadn't returned home. He called the hospital, but was told that she'd left at 11 the previous night. He then called Audrey's mom, Shirley, and asked if she had stayed over at her place. Shirley had only just returned from a Florida vacation with Audrey's daughter from her first marriage, and naturally her mother was excited to be reunited with her. So it seemed only logical that Audrey had driven to her mother's that night, only she hadn't. Shirley said that not only was Audrey not there, but she hadn't heard from her daughter at all since arriving back in New York State. Only then did it become evident that something was wrong, both Jeff and Shirley become increasingly concerned for Audrey's safety. At 10 a.m., an increasingly desperate Jeff got in touch with Audrey's stepmother and ex-police officer, who helped him file a missing persons report. However, she also advised him to call around Audrey's friends to check if any of them had seen her. The first 48 hours are crucial in any missing person's investigation, and with any luck, Jeff might be able to locate her before anything untoward occurred. One of Audrey's friends, Karina, recalls getting a voicemail from Jeff at around 1 p.m. that day saying, "Hi, Karina, it's Jeff Heron. We're having trouble locating Audrey. If you've heard from her, please call me. Thank you." Karina has since stated that the first thing that struck her about the voicemail was Jeff's unusual tone. For a man whose wife had been missing for more than 12 hours by that point, Karina claims he sounded remarkably indifferent. "You'd expect him to be panicking and anxious," she said, "but he just sounded all low and sad, almost resigned. It was only a day into the search and he sounded like he'd given up." Karina had been very vocal that Jeff did not sound concerned in this voicemail, just sad. Karina had wondered why Jeff didn't contact her earlier in the morning before Audrey was reported missing, as she was one of Audrey's best friends, and Audrey had stayed the night with her before. She also wondered why Jeff sounded low-toned and sad on the voicemail instead of panicked and concerned, considering it was less than a day into not being able to locate Audrey. Karina also noted that Jeff could be rather controlling sometimes, and that Audrey had talked of him checking up on her frequently if she went anywhere without him. So, according to her, the fact that he was content to remain in the dark regarding her whereabouts for almost 7 hours is extremely suspicious. On the evening of the day she was reported missing, Audrey's friends got together to walk the route she would have driven home that night, keeping their eyes peeled for any sign of her or her Jeep. Her friends theorized that because it was raining that night, Audrey had taken an alternate route due to the poor weather. But since they knew exactly which short road she would have turned down, they figured that they would find her and her car right away. But not a single sign of Audrey was found along the entire route, almost as if she and her vehicle had simply vanished in the thin air. Law enforcement initially speculated that there had simply been some kind of automobile accident, given that Audrey seemed to have disappeared while driving. Officers were told to keep a sharp eye out for a black Grand Cherokee while they conducted a foot search covering a 12-mile radius. Their search penetrated deep into the woods, covering every home, road, and body of water that Audrey's Jeep could have possibly ended up. Even a helicopter was called in at one point to aid in the search. But not a single shred of evidence could be located, something that mystified officers after such an intensive and rigorous search. Although relatively rare in 2002, Audrey had a car phone installed in her Jeep. But then police officers tried pinging the phone's location, and they soon found that the phone had either been disconnected, deliberately switched off, or that it had died. The cops also discovered that Audrey's purse had been left at home, implying she'd forgotten to take it to work with her on the day of her disappearance. This too struck her friends as unusual. Her life was in that purse, and even if she'd forgotten it, she would have probably turned around to retrieve it. It made them suspect that she actually had gotten home that night, and that something had occurred after her arrival at home that has caused her disappearance. Investigators were able to pull only one security camera tape from the area where Audrey was last seen. We only had one grainy video from Cumberland Farms in which it appears that Audrey's vehicle does leave her place of employment and basically turns left, going west on Country Route 23B. That's the last of any kind of technological evidence we had, one senior investigator later reported. We can't confirm it's the vehicle, but it appears to be, because the quality of the video was very poor and very grainy, and it does appear to leave at the time that she would have ended work. In the years since Audrey's disappearance, the police have investigated well over 1,000 leads, but not a single one of them has ever led to an arrest or court conviction. "There are a couple of persons of interest, but no direct link to her disappearance," stated investigating detectives. "At this point, clearly we suspect foul play. It's clearly a very frustrating case for us because there are no solid leads to follow." In 1998, Audrey and Jeff had had their first child together, a bright-eyed baby girl named Katie. But within a year, rumors flew that Audrey was planning on leaving Jeff, taking Katie with her. Yet many have testified that Jeff did not treat Sanzia very well at all, who was Audrey's daughter from her first marriage. They claimed he had a habit of yelling at Sanzia, although the girl later explained that although Jeff was harsh with her at times, She described herself as a bratty child and felt that Jeff was a good stepfather overall. Jeff and Audrey, shortly after the latter discovered that she was pregnant with her second child, Quinn, whom she gave birth to in 2000. Soon after this, the couple moved to Freehold, New York, and began building the house of their dreams on a golf course that Jeff's father owned. Life seemed serene for the couple after that, but when Audrey vanished, neither Jeff nor his family actively searched for her, outside of a few phone calls, and they didn't appear too emotionally shook up about it either. Jeff claimed he was perfectly cooperative during the investigation and contributed financially to a private search effort, but these claims are contradicted by several news outlets who argue that not only did he ignore them, but that his monetary donations to Audrey's friend's PI fund were pitiful. They claim that for a man that came from a very wealthy background, his donation of just $1,000 spoke volumes about his family's attitude towards his wife's disappearance. Although Jeff claims his reluctance to mount a serious campaign of public appeals was motivated by his desire to protect his children from the macabre maelstrom of rumors and accusations regarding the death of their mother. A few months after the media circus surrounding Audrey's disappearance had died down, representatives of the Montel Williams show reached out to Jeff to book an appearance. Characteristically, he declined, but Aubrey's circle of close friends jumped at the offer of re-exposing her case to the public. After all, anything that might produce new leads or clues was worth the effort, and they harshly resented Jeff for turning his back on such an opportunity. Then in 2017, Crime Watch Daily attempted to arrange an interview with him at his home. Again, he declined, but the wall of silence had been so prevailing by that point that Jeff's father agreed to participate. In a segment that aired later that year, he told Crime Watch that he firmly believed that his son had no involvement in his wife's disappearance, and that it would have been easy for someone to dispose of the Jeep to erase any evidence of a potential crime. During the same segment, a police investigator revealed that Jeff had partially completed a lie detector test during the initial investigation, but that his father had essentially pulled him out of it under the advice of his attorney. Some have viewed this as highly suspicious, but considering how inaccurate the test can be, and how a faulty reading could be used to gain a false conviction, Jeff's father could well have been right to stop the test. In the light of the fact that Jeff had permitted full police searches of his home on three separate occasions, it looks less and less likely that he's anything resembling the guilty party. Audrey's daughter from her first marriage, Sonia, who's not related by blood, has actually been very defensive of Jeff over the years and is a staunch believer in his innocence. She publicly stated that some of the media portrayals of her stepfather amounted to nothing but hit pieces, pieces of hack journalism that tried to sensationalize something deeply personal to her, and for all the wrong reasons. At first glance, there appears to have been no financial motivation for Jeff to disappear his wife. He came from a wealthy golf course owning family, she had no life insurance, and she didn't have much in the way of savings either. But as you're about to hear, we can't rule out greed as a motivation for her murder. Jeff's father only partly owned the golf course that had made him rich. The other owner is a Russian national, one believed to be involved in serious organized crime, who also lived on the golf course not too far from Jeff and Audrey. Apparently, when police asked Jeff about the possibility of this mysterious Russian being involved in his wife's murder, he mentioned something curious. Audrey had mentioned walking in on an argument between the silent Russian partner, Ron, and a number of other men, who were exchanging harsh words and hushed voices. The men grew silent as soon as they detected her presence, and Audrey left feeling very intimidated. It's also been theorized that the golf course was nothing but a front for the Russian mafia, who in turn leached funds from the business until Jeff's father was in their pocket. If this was the case, Audrey's disappearance could have been meant as a warning to him of what would happen if he didn't pay up. Yet whether the murder was intentional, or Audrey died in the process of being taken, is entirely up for debate, as police have never deemed the theory worthy of investigation. In 2016, a tip came from a woman whose mother had worked at the very same healthcare facility as Audrey. She claimed that her brother had caught sight of Audrey on a handful of occasions while ferrying his mother to and from the hospice, and had developed a dangerous obsession with her. This man had a long history of indecent assault and attempted kidnapping, and he became one of the prime suspects in Audrey's disappearance. New York State Police ended up draining a pond near the man's Catskill home, while corpse-sniffing dogs scoured the nearby countryside. But like countless searches that had taken place before, not a single shred of evidence was found. However, both Shirley and Sonia believe this obsessive individual is to blame, and purport that he could have been hiding in her Jeep before Audrey got in to leave work that day, and because the back doors in her Jeep apparently did not lock, it's then that her abductor struck. Audrey was recorded on CCTV, departing her workplace with no unusual indicators, but what happened after she left the parking lot is anyone's guess. In light of such a theory, it's safe to say the police have ruled out the possibility of a car accident and are focusing on the sole possibility of foul play. They've also ruled out the possibility that Audrey simply ran away, given her promotion at work and how much she loved her job. She was also a devoted mother and led an active social life, suggesting that if she did run away, that she'd have informed a friend or taken her kids along with her. Over the years, many tips have come in from all over New York and neighboring states from people claiming to have spotted Audrey alive and well, but as you can imagine, nothing has ever come of any of them. What's frustrating about this case is that the number one suspect is essentially incapable of committing the crime. In order to successfully evade detection, Audrey's killer would have had the resources and time to dispose of a huge automobile and essentially disappear it from the face of the earth. This would have been nigh impossible for one single person to do, unless they had some kind of subterranean body shop at their disposal. But this would suggest a network of motivated, twisted individuals, dedicated on abducting and disappearing those unfortunate enough to be caught on the roads at night. And if that really is a possibility, a rational way to explain this disappearance, then maybe none of us are as safe as we'd like to believe. We're supposed to feel safe in our vehicles, machines built with safety belts, airbags, and roll cages. But Audrey's disappearance shows that we're just as vulnerable as our forebears while on dark country roads. And just like back then, predators stalk the highways in search of fresh meat. The town that I lived in has developed a lot since this story. But when this happened, there was a lot of factories spread out with lots of land in between them. There was a Walmart being built in the area, but it had barely started construction. There was a main highway that ran through there, but my mom didn't like taking it as much as traffic would get bad most of the time. The side streets we would take were desolate and not much light. There was also little to no cars taking these streets. I can't remember where we were coming from that night, but in the car that night was my mom, my brother, who is 3 years younger than me, and myself. My mom is obviously driving, I'm in the passenger seat, and my brother is sitting behind me. My mom is the sweetest person ever, but is very adamant that she will never stop to help somebody on the side of the road or pick somebody up, especially when her kids were in the car. She does, however, make sure that she calls the police so they can help. It was around 9 p.m. and we were going home when my mom and I spot someone on the side of the road by the passenger's side with their hood up. Nothing out of the ordinary as my mom slows down a little since it is dark outside and doesn't want to harm anybody that might be fixing their car. As soon as we are close to the car, this guy steps out from around the hood of the car towards the street and is waving us down. I don't remember much of a description because I wasn't paying much attention. Plus, I could barely see the man, but I do remember feeling bad that we weren't at least going to stop to see what he needed. The man at this point is in the middle of the road waving his hands, but as we come up to the car, we don't see anybody else in the car. So my mom swerves around him and tells my brother to find her phone and her purse that was on the floor between the front and back seats. I look at my mom and she looks in her rearview mirror and her face goes white and her eyes get wide. My mom slams her foot on the accelerator. This is highly unusual for my mom as she is really good at going the speed limit. At this point, I know something is wrong. My mom's voice goes high and in a panicked voice is asking my brother where her phone is. I'm yelling at her what's going on. All this chaos is freaking my brother out with him being so little he's crying and can't find the phone. My mom keeps her eyes on the road but keeps glancing up continuously at her rearview mirror and finally answers, "He's following us." I'm not sure what she was talking about, but know that this isn't a good situation. My mom is speeding towards the highway, and thank goodness there's no traffic. I look in the back window and see somebody passing cars trying to keep up with my mother. I ask her where she's going, and she told me that she's heading to the police station. As we are getting close, my mom tells me to jump out of the car as soon as she stops the car and grab my brother from the back seat while she runs around the car to meet us. My mom stops right in front of the police station and doesn't even wait for the car to fully come to a stop before she puts the car in park. I open my car door as fast as I can and grab my brother, who has quickly opened his door. I take off in a full sprint with my brother in one hand and my mom on the other hand. Once we finally talk to a police officer is when I finally understand the full extent of what happened. My mom told the police officer that once we had passed the guy with a broke down car, he quickly ran to the hood of his car and slammed it. He then got into his car and sped after us. That was when my mom knew that this guy had horrible intentions for us. She said he kept trying to speed up to get on the side of us, but she was able to speed up to avoid that. Once my mom turned toward the police station, she said the guy had stopped following. She gave the best description of the guy and his car, but because everything happened so fast, she didn't get a license plate number. I'm pretty sure the police never found him. I'm also not sure what the guy had planned for us if we had actually stopped to help, but I know that it was nothing good.